Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
Welcome. The party starts now. Welcome to another exciting edition of Soma Time. I'm back. The rain is out there. The pain is out there. Wow. It's going to be one of those nights. One of those exo summer nights. Wow. This is the... Every time I land here every week at 9 o'clock, I'm overwhelmed with how much information I have to organize and somewhat direct towards your eardrums. But this week... kind of an easy trip for this end of the phone, because life has done it for us, hasn't it? It's really made things obvious. And when you look around and take sort of a 360-degree tour of the culture, what do you see? A couple of celebrity breakups, right? Lindsay Lohan messing with her ankle bracelet, not good. Couple of shows got picked up for the summer, right? Some weird stuff going on between Washington and the military, and then there was a little bit of a, you know, primary thing last night, the elections, that's still washing through. Speaking of washing through, the Washington Nationals trotted out their new phenom last night, 14 strikeouts, you know, for the rookie. And everybody was, you know, rejoicing about that. But not this reporter. No. No, I could care less. I was much more interested in my Metsies, who had a little magic of their own last night. You follow this program, you know, the Mets are right now tonight, by the way. That's why I'm deviating from the script a little bit. But last night in the 11th inning, we had some fireworks of our own up here while... Strasburg was doing his thing down there in D.C., right? Let's see if I can get this to play here. The video will begin in 13 seconds. My whole life is delayed. 9, 8. Anyway, our rookie, Ike Davis, strides to the plate to lead off the bottom of the 11th and does this.
Back to that splitter, and Davis hits it to deep right field. That ball is out of here. Ike Davis with a home run to win it for New York.
I see the radio call is much better. I don't know if I can snag that. I'll try and look for it while you guys are listening to the interview. But just if you've ever stood in the Pepsi porch and looked down toward home plate and seen the Ants playing baseball, the shot that he hit last night, unforgettable. I mean, just he's got that great swing too. You see, you know it's gone. You just look up and go boop boop. Look at that. Yeah, Pelfrey, all that. All right, well, there you go. There's your little Met moment for the night because it is pouring and flushing, if you can process that. So there'll be no baseball tonight. Two games tomorrow, though. Santana goes at 1 o'clock. Hey. Number to call to get on the air tonight is going to be a brief window. But the number is the same, 646-478-4847. That is 646-478-4847. I'll be opening up the chat room in a momentito. Anybody have any questions? Things going on? Now, a couple of announcements. If you sashay over to my website, which is somaspace.org, right on the home page, you see a little link there for the Somatic Seasonal Survey, otherwise known as Summer Stock. You click on that, and it gives you kind of a question and answer about things you've been doing since the spring began, as we now have begun the first week of the summer cycle in Soma Land, even though the solstice is a week or so away, whatever it is, 20th, 21st, or somewhere there. We start our 12-week cycle because we follow the moon here at Soma time. So we have a new moon coming in on the 12th, this Saturday, which will be the last new moon of the official spring, first new moon of the Somatic summer. So it's sort of like where the worlds collide and overlap, and we'll probably have our pagan pal, Professor Val, on soon. We got Father's Day coming up. There's a lot of things in June that have to do with, this ontification, if we'll call it that, this personalization of the year. Everything that you remember about 2009, say, right? There's a peak of the season in the summer, middle of August to be exact, wherever we get to the full moon there. That's the high point of the roller coaster, the somatic roller coaster. And it's what project did you get done? What was the fruit that ripened on the vine of intention as the year went by? And as we get to this part of the season, when we're cusping, it's almost as if as the spring ends, all that intention, all that backswing now has to start coming down the ladder towards follow-through, a little golfing metaphor for you. So, you know, we're doing shows this month that deal with a lot of people that are cutting-edge type people. They're game changers. Last week we had Martha Neslon. She did a beautiful job of really expressing how important it was for her to use her position as a practitioner in chiropractic to really help people understand what it's like to live their truth. And she went through her story. Very, very phylogenic of her because she's wired that way. How are you wired? Well, funny you should ask that. Again, go back to somaspace.org, click through to see Meet the Four Domains, and figure out which one of them you were designed to be. Because everybody goes through their brain development, and then one of those four basic wiring templates gets, ingrained into your system, and that's the way you're going to build your personality, all the things that you do to support it, all the things you use to mature within it, and ultimately your longevity depends on being able to blend in the other patterns that we talk about there. So I won't go too off on a rant on the four domains tonight. I want to kind of kick it tonight. Keep it light because tonight, live from Philadelphia, as we journey down the Jersey Turnpike, they are competing right now in the second period, and the Blackhawks have a goal, and the Flyers have a goal. Almost had two goals. I hate doing that. So we're going to be somacasting the Stanley Cup final here. Hopefully the game will end before 10:30, but maybe not. It started at 8, so it might be pretty close, but We might know the winner. We might be able to tell you. If the Blackhawks are, they're looking for the clincher tonight. So this should be interesting to see how if Philly can force a seventh game here. You know, we had the Lakers last night up there beating the Celtics in Boston. So, yeah, home ice in this series has been everything. No road team has won yet. Here we are, six games into the series. So this is pretty interesting. See how this thing turns out. Wow. This is going to be one of those wild games. Let's take a minute or two to take a look at this here, because there's a lot of action going on. Oh, there's a dude on the ground now. This could be a five-minute major. Let's check it out.
How many minutes? Well, Scotty Hartnell made an unbelievable play at the blue line to get the puck to Billy Leno. And you talked about Dennis Savard, the Savardian spinorama, a missed opportunity for Billy Leno. There you see the stick or the hand of Scott Hartnell come up. And Cliff Nicholas Jalmerson.
One of their goons.
Well, what an opportunity right before for Billy Leno. Watch the patience.
Bet he gives him 4 minutes here, too.
And he just misses on the short side with Patrick Sharp, a forward back playing defense.
Harry Holzer with a turnover. Sivan Gagne coming in all alone.
In a minute here, I'm gonna play a video for you that I'm surfing all over to find some clips on how important the Stanley Cup is to the culture of hockey. And you know, we're gonna talk a little bit tonight about subcultures and how they contribute to the main culture. You know, hockey is such an obscure sport. So it looks like we got a 4 minute major here. So I'll keep you posted on what's happening here. But I want to talk to you about my experiences with the Stanley Cup and how it affects you. This is the oldest trophy in the major sports. And what, they only give him 2 minutes? Well, that happened. I mean, he wasn't bleeding. And it has a unique quality to it, because unlike other trophies like the Lombardi Trophy or in baseball, they just give them the it looks like a bunch of flags, you know, metal flags. I saw the two Met trophies. They look very similar from 1969 and 1986. It's just a bunch of pennants, you know. And in basketball, Larry O'Brien Trophy, there's no names written on it. It's just a trophy every year. You know, they present the trophy, and the trophy goes away. Same thing with Vince Lombardi, you know. But the Stanley Cup is only one of those. And your name gets on it, and it's chronicling the history of hockey. And for these kids that grow up, you know, in the wilds of Canada, where this is their dream, the hockey is their sport. We saw that play out in the Olympics. We talked about it back in the winter, about the paradigms between countries and how they own certain sports. We got the World Cup starting next week. I want a little piece on that a little bit, if I can get somebody on to talk about the passion that's behind that. Because another one of the things, you're representing your not just your culture, but sort of like your worldview at the same time. So I found this clip here about the Stanley Cup. It's a commercial that they put on to promote the finals here. And this is a kind of a montage of a bunch of guys talking about the Stanley Cup from the perspective of the hockey world. Just check out the emotions here.
Your feelings are on winning this cup.
Exactly. There are no words, is what it says. And you just watch the video on YouTube. There's about half a dozen guys going by, just shaking their heads, squeezing the little bridge of their nose in the somatic center, where all the tension is in their body, where everything goes through. It's this pursuit, this almost like a pilgrimage, a somatic pilgrimage, if you will, to be able to be immortalized on that cup. And I had the privilege of, when the Rangers won in 94, which seems like a million years ago, they brought the cup back here to Rye, New York, neighboring town to me, and where the Rangers practiced, and got to see the cup, got to put my business cards in the cup, got to put my keys in the cup that said Rangers on it. And, you know, you grow up a Ranger fan, they haven't won the cup for 54 years. Here's the Blackhawks, haven't won the cup since 1961. The Flyers haven't won since the back-to-back cups they won in the 70s. So when you don't, when you go that long, when you go, you know, generational cycles between winning this thing, and it happens in other sports, you know. The Red Sox fans went through this. We mentioned that with Rick Leskowitz a while ago. There's a certain sort of transpersonal and sort of intergenerational loop of bonding with a team, rooting for it through all these different eras, and your life goes on. Your life gets defined by other things, of course, but the identification with that pursuit of being a champion. When you get to this part of the year, and in June we crown the hockey, get the Stanley Cup out, and basketball comes up. Now we got a World Cup that's going to start up. We got the Wimbledon Championships at the end of the month that bleed into July. We just had the French Open last week. So a lot of things happen in June, end of the spring, beginning of the summer, that has to do with fruition. Same thing we see, you know, coming out of the winter in February with baseball starting up and football ending, and the seasons within a season is what I'm trying to get at with these sports. They're very interwoven into different events during the course of the year and what they really mean. So, and I'm sure if I, you know, cornered anybody on the street, they couldn't tell me who won the Stanley Cup last year, you know, or let alone 10 years ago. And by not being part of the hockey world, you know, per se, being a hockey fan, it might be something that you know, seems insignificant, but I can remember where I was when certain cups were won. You know, for example, like today's the anniversary of my sister Denise and her husband Anthony. They're down vacationing in the Caribbean. They got married 9 years ago today. Why is that? Why did that? When I saw that this morning go by on the crawl on the Facebook, I'm like, oh, okay. What I remember was, hey, this is the day that the Avalanche won the cup against the Devils, and Ray Bourque finally got his cup. You know, it's like that's the stupidity of hockey. It gets into you. It tattoos your soul in a way like no other sport. Because when you're watching hockey, and I get into this a little bit with our guest here at on the Safe Line coming up at the bottom of the hour, Elizabeth Streb, is hockey very much like her action mechanics, which she perceives as art, as a movement form, instead of just pictures and things like that. There's dynamic art, there's expressive art, creative art through dance. Hockey's the same way for me, because I play hockey on every surface imaginable, but when you're playing hockey, there's a certain heartbeat to it, different than other sports, because the rink, it's just the word rink, it's encapsulated. You're so separate from the outside world, you're so in a space, a soma space even, that becomes part of you. You're playing certain rinks, you know, these boards give, and these boards are lively, and the ice over there is mushy, and the ice over there is really clean. All these little nuances become part of you. And when you watch hockey all year long, different rinks, different stadiums, like the one in Pittsburgh, the Igloo that just closed down, that had a certain personality. The Red Wings ice has a certain personality to it. Of course, Madison Square Garden has a certain personality to it. So because we're talking in terms of exosomatic signatures, these structures that become part of our lives, hockey being so equipment-bound that everything about it is so reliant on equipment, where other sports, you know, baseball, you got a glove, basketball, you know, what, you got a wristband, yeah, nothing. And football, the equipment is so sort of almost like it overwhelms you that you sort of become – used to it, and when you see it on people playing. But hockey, nobody really knows what it's like to, you know, on a daily basis. They know what it's like to feel what it's like when you're getting ready to play hockey. It is like jousting in a way. You suit up, and there's a feeling of being, I don't want to say invincible, but there's a feeling of being extremely powerful when you're ready to play hockey. Football, you feel like you're protecting yourself from injury. Hockey, you feel like you're going into to battle in a way. It's a different animal altogether, at least for me. So so that's what, you know, we're, I'm going to be tracking tonight. I'm going to hopefully we'll get some live footage of this later, but just wanted to get that out there. And I'm going to look for that 94 Cup presentation out here, too, while that's going on, because that was just, it's like there's my life before the Rangers won the Cup, and then there's my life after the Rangers won the Cup. It really is that simple. So, anyway, number again is 646-478-4847. Once we get done with the interview, which is about 48 minutes long, and we went way over time, with Elizabeth. Once we get back with her from the Cincinnati interview, we're going to kind of, you know, hopefully get the end of this game, or at least the part of the third period. It was about, looks like a couple minutes, almost 12 minutes to go in the second, so we might be early third or mid third when we get back from the interview. You know, we're going to go over a couple more things that are coming up. Hopefully next week we're going to have someone on talking about the male brain, getting ready for Father's Day. And some of the other things that stood out from the news this week, some of the reactions, especially Obama's reaction to the recent developments down there. Because, you know, we're in this over 50 days now, and the phoniness is starting to add up. And when you see people saying things in ways that are not really truthful in a way. Uh-oh. Did they get a goal out of this? Let's see. Yep. Flyers just scored, folks. There it is. And for the Flyers, who I'm not rooting for.
You filthy criminals.
There's just some wild plays in this game while I'm talking. So, amazing goal. I mean, the guy, 2-on-1, and then somebody fell, bang, bang, pass, and then he roofs it. I don't know who got it. Number one by too quick. Hope it isn't Briere. I'm telling you, we're going for seven here. We're gonna be here Friday night. I'll be. You guys will be doing something else. I'll be watching this cup game. Yeah, Danny Briere, son of a bitch. All right. Get over yourselves, Philly. Anyway, like I said, I think this is going to go down to the wire tonight, at least, if not all the way back to Chicago. Which, hey, if the form holds here and the Blackhawks beat them Friday night and win the cup at home, even better. I know my Rangers were up 3-1 in the finals against Vancouver, and they went to the seventh game, and then they went to the third period. And as Howie Rose said, it was post-to-post torture. That was like passing a stone. I've watched Super Bowls and World Series and all kinds of things. But the seventh game of a Stanley Cup final, I mean, you literally would rather be dead than lose that game. It is so draining. Hockey, unlike I said, unlike other sports, the constant action and the constant sense of this rink, being in this rink, especially when you've played the game, it never leaves you. Some people get like that about golf. I can never get like that about golf. But hockey is so different. It's just got such a spirit to it that, you know, hopefully we'll get a little taste of it on the last half hour of the show. And like I said, I want to get into some of the incongruencies of what the president's been talking about in terms of how he's dealing with his emotions as an XO, and how he's trying to be this Mad Hatter, and it's not playing well anyway. So there you go. I think I'm going to start the interview early because that'll give us more time to talk on the back end of it. This is Elizabeth Streb, and again, what we're trying to get at with this particular interview is how, and in semantics, and all the stuff I talk about in this show, really, it's so outside the normal conversation. Her perception of dance and her perception of how dance can be communicated to the public is right up my alley, but it's probably not even a lane in most people's alleys. And what I really liked about what she had to say was that she didn't feel like she was the only one that had that insight. She was just one of many that acted on it. And that's the difference. When you guys stretch yourselves and find new things and get a hot idea, it's very, very rare that people can sustain that initial aha, eureka, and actually bring it to the world. I mean, I've been trying for how many years with somatics, and I get a lot of shrugged shoulders, raised eyebrows, and, don't, Philippi. But, you know, I'd like to make it more accessible to people. And I'm trying to learn from these people that have been innovating for years. And it took her a good chunk of her career to get it to this stage. It's so hard to bring you know, something new into the light, because the mainstream is there to resist, you know, changes to the status quo and maintain the cultural ethos. And when you have things coming in like the last 15, 20 years, you know, technologically and the way we communicate socially, and even something as simple as Blog Talk Radio, I mean, you couldn't imagine this, you know, a very short period of time ago. And that's why when you see what she's been doing and how she's been able to extend her message to other people and include other fields and be able to discuss it in a very you know, open way, sort of like an open source way, I just found it fascinating. So anyway, I'm going to let Elizabeth take over here, and we'll be back into the show probably around 10:15, and see what's going on here in the game. And if you have any questions, I'll be in the chat room, maybe over there, and we'll pick up the I'll be able to chat along with you, or we'll talk about it on the air when I get back. So stay tuned. Here's Elizabeth Streb and me a yapping. All right, welcome back to Summertime, and I am honored to be joined by the absolutely just fountain of information and energy, Elizabeth Streb from the Streb Lab for Action Mechanics, choreographer, author extraordinaire, and just, I had interview envy when I heard you first, so I wanted to welcome you to Summertime here and see if we can delve down a little bit of the origins of the genius that you are. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Mark.
All right. Well, we got to lighten up a little bit here because, you know, I've been talking about game changers for a while on the show, innovators, people cutting edge things. And most of the time, you know, when they come into a field, whether it's music or whether it's anything creative, let's just say, there's an immediate affinity for both the mainstream sort of learning how to do your scales, and then you become, you know, a jazz, you know, artist, something like that. And you
Right.
started... You know, with dance is such a, in a word, in the world of esoterics and things like that, it has that elitist sort of outer crust where only these people get to learn this stuff. And you had an initial resistance to that paradigm. Talk about that, because someone has an affinity for dance, and then you get to the dance community and you go, eh.
Well, exactly, Mark. My roots were very working class. I was adopted when I was 2 in Rochester, New York, by the Streb family with that great name they gave me, Streb. And I was action obsessed as a kid, and also a visual artist. I could draw and paint. So when I went to apply to college, I thought, oh, dance. I was a complete idiot savant. I thought, oh, dance. That's a combination of art and action. I'll do that. And that was, you know, then I walked through that door, and exactly what you said, I really couldn't believe that it was placed as a field and with a group of people in such a way. I thought dance would be so ubiquitous in general, but it was really not. It was peopled by, you know, very privileged people. Now, of course, I continued to train and study, got my degree in modern dance. I continued till I was in my 40s, and now I'm 60, with the training of ballet every day and also modern. And so I didn't eschew it 100%, if you know what I mean, but I noticed things
right
off the road that I think other people maybe didn't pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, from my, I guess, origins in the clinical world, I remember sitting at the back of a bus going downtown in Albany when I was in my undergrad years, and someone mentioned chiropractic out of the background conversation. I never knew much about it, and they said, well, it's the largest drugless healing art in the world. I went, really? You know, you think you'd hear about it somehow. And when you get into it, and it's all about insurance and rehab and muscles and joints, and it had nothing to do with this energy about healing, and the people that were mentors of mine were always kind of furthering the paradigm. So then I discovered somatics, very much like dance, under a rock, you know, and they're doing all this experiential stuff, and they're working with memory, and they're working with all these deep, you know, kind of disciplines that, again, you had to sort of take, you know, the lotus with the swamp in a way to kind of get what you needed out of it. So tell me how you took that energy, the affinity for action. There probably wouldn't have been enough Ritalin for either one of us, you know, growing up.
No, they didn't have it then, I don't think, you. No Ritalin.
Yeah, they...
Well,
yeah, they would have pickled the both of us. We would have been running around with a drip, because if a truck drove by the school, I was right to the window. You know, it was, oh, look,
right,
a truck.
Right.
And so I just wanted movement. I just wanted something to happen. And it seemed like the way education is set up, especially with all the special, especially with all the ways they've refined it now. It's funny, the more information they get, the more they make it rigid. Is how do you break through? Because you do a lot of communication to different skill levels, different age groups. How do you take your message, which is extremely visceral, extremely like basic and primary, and bring it out to the public and make it a common experience when it's been rooted in such a, you know, like I said, kind of an elite experience?
Oh, yeah, well, I started out, Mark, ages ago by noticing things I felt were missing. Like, well, wait, I wonder why dance camouflages gravity. Why does dance spend so much time camouflaging it? Hey, I think I won't. Let me jump off a ladder and see what happens if I don't, you know, abet my landing. Or what about saying, okay, I'm not going to always be right side up. I'm not going to always have the base of my support be the bottoms of my feet. So all of a sudden, and I believe that humans could fly. So all of a sudden, even just those three precepts, you know, I started experimenting in my studio alone. Then I'd go to dance class and I'd go, no, I think I've got something here. Let me go back into my studio and try this other bunch of moves. And I really asked particular questions, you know, why can't we incorporate extreme forces on the body and set up a condition that would promulgate them and then watch what would happen rather than always being in control, you know what I mean? So I thought always being in control was really mostly tantamount to the exhibition of privilege. That's why I think the general public doesn't go to dance, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to put something in there raw and rowdy and dangerous and something that the everyday human that actually labors for a living would recognize across the footlights.
And it has that, you know, if anyone goes to the site and checks out her work, there is a circus element to what you do, and it's streb.org. You can check out the videos there, and you have these open, the rehearsals that you do for the public, that people can actually watch you, you know, basically develop some of these structures that you talk about. And again, it goes back to that. I'm plagiarizing from your interview with Bob Salter about the experience with your dad. Growing up, you know, holding the sheetrock over your head, that whole experience of having an intimacy with structure that most people in dance, because it's an attention, and I've taken care of a lot of, New York City ballet types and things like that, and they're it's very much about their physical structure, their body, their form, not necessarily the external. And you've made a connection between the internal sense of fluidity, or I'll get fancy for a second, tensegrity, which is an architecture word. Yeah, I know. Everyone just from flat. What the heck is that? Go, you know.
But
we can't move him. If we can't move people to Wikipedia in 20 minutes, then, you know, we've done something else. But tensegrity has that property of having a continuum, and that's the basics of somatics, of self and surroundings. That's what I was attracted to about your work, because you don't separate the dancer from what they're dancing in or on or what's helping them move. And that creates a fluidity where some person would have skill level X and, you know, maybe they're naturally able to do certain things, and then someone that has X minus, and now they're experiencing the same invigoration that the person that's the expert has because the structure's doing it for them, and they're getting that experience, like you said, of flying, which is what you experience when you're in flow no matter what you're doing.
I mean, I think that's the idea of harnessing invisible forces and naming them. I mean, what you're speaking about perhaps is we have these action machines, because I always thought, well, the music industry made machines, because perhaps at one time somebody said, hey, the human voice is not sufficient to express all we want to express in sound. So they made the harpsichord and the flute, you know, and the guitar, the violin. And I thought, well, yeah, that should happen in action, because I want to get all the way up there 30 feet up. I can't jump that high, not yet anyway. So we would make a hamster wheel for people, or we'd attach ourselves to bungee cords. Or actually, Mark, we would just dive off, you know, 20, 30-foot scaffoldings and land on a one-foot mat. You know, we'd fall. But the fact of the matter is, what I think the audience feels when you're doing these extreme things with kind of force manufacturers that these pieces of equipment end up being, they really feel the air change, I think. You know, it goes smacking into them. Because we're not just doing moves they recognize with the biomechanical facility of the body. It's way more than that.
Yeah, and that transpersonal experience is what's the gut experience that draws you to dance. And I love the fact that you always refer to it as action, because dance always sounds so formal and imposed, where you know, we're living in an age now where there's mixed martial arts, there's extreme sports. Sean White, I always think of, what would you do with a guy like him, you know, in your studio?
Right.
That'd be kind of wild. There's a meshing of those worlds, and which I think is great and overdue. And I just see that the boundaries that you're breaking down aren't just within fields, that they're actually within perception of those fields from outside of them, where people say, that's not for me because, and here's the blank, and I fill it in. And I never even go down that street even just to see what's there. This is a way to say, you know, everybody's been to a circus. Everyone's seen an acrobat. You know, everyone's seen a daredevil. You know, and it's that sort of, amusement parks even are an extension of what you're doing in a way. And it's that's why we go to these things. That's why we go to the blockbuster movies, to have that same kind of rush, especially now with IMAX theater and things. I can imagine your stuff in an IMAX theater. Wow.
I mean,
I just think that education has been totally undersold to the public, because it promotes not just the initial visceral experience, but that thirst to have more. That, like, I don't think you're ever going to be done in your work, as other people can be done in their creative cycle, and they say, this is the body of my work, and now I play my greatest hits, and, you know, I do my VH1 tour, and I'm done. Because your stuff is not limited to you, it just keeps extending to other people, and it has that fractal quality to it. So talk about the lab and how you see it developing from here, and what directions do you think it's going to be going as people get more contact with your work?
Well, I think it's a great way you quantified it, and just in general, you know, what we operate with Streb, and the name of the technique is Pop Action. And a lot of the information from Pop Action came from a martial art that I studied for many years ago called Wu Mei Kung Fu. But we operate on a personal best place of departure. And that means that, no, you probably don't want to go home and try this right away, you know, because we are professionals. Do not try this at home. However, there's a part of every single thing that Streb does in their extreme action show that every person on earth could do, whether you're 1.5 or 80 or 90. And that's the beauty of this. You kind of sit there in the theater, or when you come into SLAM, which is in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and yes, it's a new civic experiment, which means it's always open to the public. You know, it's a 7-Eleven, not a church kind of idea. But what we're trying to promulgate is, this is a way of, I feel like Streb Elizabeth, has founded a way, a particular way of asking questions about action, about space, time, and the body, and forces. And it's a platform for the investigation of movement that anyone who's obsessed with movement can come in and tamper with and come out with their own product. That's what I think the beauty of this is. It's not just my body of work, although I'm very proud of it, you know, but it's not about just that.
And that alone makes you rare again, because in the field of dance or any artistic endeavor, the ego is so prominent, and because of the most artists are not really appreciated till they're dead, unfortunately. And so anytime you discover something, and even in the healing arts, I mean, you know, I didn't learn technique approaches in chiropractic. I learned guys' names. I learned Pettibon. I learned this. It was always the work of one guy. It was a practitioner's repertoire.
Wow.
And, you know, it happens in every field of creativity. What I'm interested in is that now that the work has been sort of distributed and sort of like almost like, you know, transfused into this is probably a second generational cycle now. You've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
Do you find that the new people coming in aren't beholden to the teacher, that they become, you know, that I always talk about in somatics, that first person authority kicks in, where the I can, you know, kicks in with them right away because of the fact that there's no filter? Or do you have to go through that sort of apprenticeship stage or that learning curve to undo all the counter messages that they got from the culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, because the dancers in my company, I still call them dancers, although they're gymnasts and acrobats and every other thing, daredevils, they have to have years and years and years of training. I mean, there's no way around that. So they come in infused with a lot of ballet, a lot of modern dance, a lot of sports, a lot of gymnastics. However, the right person, and we choose the dancers in the Streb company, of which there are 8, very, very carefully. And I don't choose people who, here's a typical dance issue. I care about whether I'm a good dancer, how do I look. All of those types of attitudes are not and not held by these dancers. So I make sure what you're saying, Mark, is that, you know, do we have to go through this filter system so they drop all of that information they've gotten? No, because once you come to Streb, it's sort of the caboose on the train. You've already, you know,
right,
become disenchanted with dance in general.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the misfit island that somatics has become over the years, because it started out in the backwaters of humanistic psychology in the late 60s, and then it went through the whole, you know, decade of the 70s with the S stuff and all the, you know, the transpersonal psychology that came out of that. Then it went through its, you know, cosmic stage in the 80s, and everybody was reading A Queer Conspiracy and all that stuff. And then the 90s, the brain stuff came in, and then it got really into the you know, the cyber, you know, kind of cybernetic aspects of it, and sort of got, you know, stuck in the neurons, if you ask me. And then the last decade or so, because of the fact that there's been so much attention on brain development and how brains actually learn and change, that it's gone back to its roots of movement and on self-awareness, which is why the stuff you're doing to me should be on every street corner, because most people don't move. And the
right,
few that do don't move that well.
Exactly.
They don't move very often, and they don't move very well when they do move.
I mean, it's almost a trajectory as people get older and older and older. They're on this trajectory towards absolute stillness. Like the people
mm-hmm.
that end up being even sometimes 30, 35, 40-year-olds, they just stop moving. And Streb, really, we do this thing after our show. At Slam, we have about 12 weeks of shows a year when, you know, we're not touring, which we do. I have an agent, and we tour all over the United States and the world, really. But at Slam, we have this thing called Slam Inclusive. So on Saturday nights during the seasons, which you can check out on streb.org, our website, whenever you feel like it, it's Slam Inclusive, and you buy this bracelet for $5 or $10. And after the show's over, you either fly in our flying trapeze, jump on the trampoline, or come onto the mats and do some pop action. And you can't imagine, Mark, how popular. I thought, well, this is an experiment. I don't know how many people are going to participate. It was crazy popular. Everybody wanted.
Could you imagine being a kid, and after the circus is over, you get to go on the, you know, come
I
on,
know.
This is, you know.
I mean, that's what
this
a great
is
idea,
like,
right?
We're in a world of such passive and sort of, you know, technologically dependent stimulation, whether it's from the internet or whether it's from, you know, our freaking iPhones, that the motor side of the equation, because somatics is about a sensory motor coupling, is the gap between the input and then the expression is sometimes separated by hours or weeks. When you go to a circus, it's immediate. It's an eye body experience. Like, wow, I want to do that. And the fact that you're breaking that fourth wall down is what, you know, to me makes your stuff so, to me, it's almost like catnip. I can't understand why this isn't everywhere yet. But and hopefully, like I said, as we come out of this malaise with everybody getting drugged up that you know, has any kind of fidgety behavior, maybe we'll have a place for them in the universe.
Well, you know, it's also viral. You know, we're basically committed mm-hmm. to taking over the world with extreme action, two minds at a time. You know, and I, of course, was ensconced in the downtown experimental dance world from, you know, the 70s through well into the 90s and through early 2000. I don't think I didn't have a major agent until I was in my middle 40s. You know, so it took that long just in my studio doing New York things to really figure out this idea. So that might be one of the reasons why it's not all over the place yet.
Well, we have you know, eternity, but I'm looking at it from the standpoint of from the point where someone actually makes contact with your world, whether it's through, and we haven't talked about the book yet. I want to mention the book, or through one of these events you do, or by going to like the camp coming up this summer. From the moment of contact, I would imagine that there's a high conversion rate to immersion. You know, once someone says this is an outlet for me that would in some ways transcend therapy, transcend a lot of the, you know,
yeah,
like I said, a lot of the numb and dumb ways of going about, you know, getting over yourself in a way.
Right. Oh, it's beautiful. Beautifully put. I think that it changes people permanently, you know, and I think to be an artist, I mean, movement changes people permanently in all these, you know, transcendent ways. And I think you really, you know, when I got Slam, when I was in my early 50s, I really had to ask myself, Okay, Streb, what's your civic responsibility here? Do you want to just keep working on your career? I mean, you've got every award. There's not a Pulitzer Prize waiting for a choreographer, in other words.
Right.
And even if there were, you know, enough already. And I really started to think, wow, the United States needs to figure out the culture thing, and it cannot be in the ivory towers only of Lincoln Center and BAM and all of these fancy places. Because, you know, let's face it, the 345 million people are not going into those fancy theaters. They don't want to, and they're not comfortable. So how do we figure out how to have public places that are civically based and invite the whole world in? That's what one of our projects is.
Now, what I want to see happen is that, you know, because there's been a slight media obsession lately with the world of dance. There's all these dance reality shows. You just had the Dancing with the Stars thing a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
As someone who's you know, embedded in that world, when you watch these shows, do you see the public getting, you know, just because they're watching dance is good enough, or do you see that, wow, if they could be watching what you guys are doing? And because it just seems like every one of these shows, it's all about basically busting a lot of people's egos down and making them look a little foolish, and then having the dance, the partners being looked at as, oh, you'll never be this, and that judgment aspect of it, where in your world, it isn't about judgment. It's much, much more about having the experience and the perception of being able to have, like you say, that superhero kind of sense. So I guess kind of bridge the gap between the message that you're getting from those reality shows and the message you're putting out in your book. And I'll just give the title quick here for everybody if you haven't picked this up. It's How to Become an Extreme Action Hero. And you're jumping, I think, with a trampoline kind of harness thing on the cover here. That discusses the journey you went through, basically, from your origins up there in the Finger Lakes to now. So kind of connect those dots for me. What the message coming out of your book and the message you're getting from all these dance shows on TV, are they simpatico, or are they go 95 north and 95 south? What do you see?
Well, I think, you know, we actually America's Got Talent actually invited Streb a year ago to go to LA and audition for America's Got Talent.
Oh.
With a piece that has a picture in the book. It's called Gauntlet. We have these two 90-pound cement blocks swinging in opposite directions, and there's a dance that we do around them and try not to get hit by them. But, you know, so I really had, I just wanted to mention, a very deep experience about these reality TV shows, and we actually participated in them. I don't think it's so much about the models, the cookers, the singers, the dancers, or the music, or the singers. Yeah, I don't think it's about that, Mark. I think it is about, on some level, almost a Romanesque thing, the Colosseum thing about public humiliation. You know, I think the audience, I don't really, in terms of the dance part of that, Dancing with the Stars, I don't fully believe people want to watch people dance. I think they want to dance. And I think that's one of the missing links in modern dance is that, yeah, you sit there and, you know, I'm watching you dance. You know, I call it step dancing because you're really not flying. You're staying on the bottoms of your feet and transferring weight in all of these many ways. You're still only in two-dimensional space. You're in a comfort zone. You know where you are. You're right side up. I think that's just not about dancing or action at all. I think it's a totally other subject. I myself find it kind of boring, although I could turn it on. I don't like that kind of dancing. I think it's artificial and silly.
Now, how do you juxtapose that with the much, much more visceral, sensual world of, like, the pole dancing that's gone on? That's become huge. And you know, people go to these things as a form of exercise, and it's one of those things that would get you out of the off the ground, so to speak, but it's done, you know, the way they sell things, it's either sex, violence, or something, you know, it's done with a pretense where, you know, trapeze work and other stuff is much, much seen more as gymnastics. So do you think the pole dancing community is closer to what you're saying, actually, because it's a little more raw, it's a little more, you know, unscripted?
Closer. You know, it's using equipment, it's being in another place in space, right? I mean, I think that's at least a start towards what I'm talking about. And I think that I just don't know what's going to happen to the lifetime performing arts action-based thing in the next 20 years. And I think that it remains to be seen. It's very hard to predict. You know, it's very hard to predict. I still think people are wanting, the question is, how are people going to want to gather in the 21st century? And that's the question that we're asking. And our solution to that is this extreme action show, though, even though during the show in the theater, you're not doing it as an audience. You feel by the end as if you have done some of the moves. That's how extreme it is.
Yeah.
So that's sort of our
very similar. The message you're getting out and sort of conveying, and we're talking with Elizabeth Streb from Slam here, from Streb Live for Action Mechanics. Very similar to what Tommy Major from the band In Train talks about, because they do these Drumming for Peace musical festivals, where he says, look, all you need to be a drummer is a heartbeat. And basically he puts people into that. Everyone's a drummer. You know, you have a heartbeat. And it's about entraining it, and that rhythm. And even if you watch a couple, if you guys just go to YouTube or just go to her site and watch a couple of videos of these people moving around, you go right through the monitor, you're in it. And there's a difference between that and watching someone do perfect, you know, ballroom dancing or even some of the ice skating that people like in the Olympics, which I just can't watch. It just seems so much slower and so much more distant. I can't identify with it. With the stuff you guys do, it's stuff I would watch kids do. I mean, I remember making ramps and stuff when I was a kid, you know, riding on a bicycle, Evel Knievel style, and it was, you know, kind of a primitive form of extreme sports back then in the 70s. You know, the equipment wasn't too good. But, you know, when somebody sprained an ankle or somebody broke an arm, and it got exciting. You know,
it got exciting. You get hurt.
There was that element of danger. See, when you see the perfect dancer, there's no element of surprise. It's all very kind of ornate and very kind of, you know, very nice, but it doesn't really do much for me. Where your stuff, because of the fact that it involves that element of guts or daring, or there's some risk involved, you got kind of a NASCAR feel to you at some point.
I think so. I think with NASCAR, I also think, Mark, I think that when you're watching the other kind of dancing that you're talking about, like Dancing with the Stars or figure skating on ice, nothing's really going to happen. I don't know what I'm watching, really. There's nothing causally that's going to happen that's going to surprise me, ever. And I think that when you're watching Streb, real calamity could occur. Our dancers, Streb dancers and myself when I was a practitioner, I think to be an extreme action hero or actioneer, you have to agree to get hurt when you walk in that room. You got to agree that you're not so precious that you can't get hurt. And you say, okay, I'm going to get hurt, and I'm going to pay such close attention in every millisecond, in every millimeter, that I am not going to die, but I'm probably going to get banged up. There's no question about it.
And again, I kind of equate you with on a continuum with like what Penn and Teller did with magic and what Blue Man Group did with their way of portraying things, where the audience was very intimately involved with what was going on. With what you guys are doing, it's an active audience, not a passive audience. It's an audience that's actually emotionally engaged, and they leave there with that vibe. And, you know, I just don't see that culturally being, like, you're on an unpaved road because we're so passive and we're so removed and we're so content with the sensory that the movement part is tough to inspire people. So I guess in a backhanded kind of way, I'm kind of asking you, how could you get, the paradigm of somatics, which is about having the stillness within you with having the dynamic around you, how do you get a message out that I guess would be that when one is very common but also very muted to a public that's used to using their body as sort of a shield, as a way to defend them from emotions and to numb them from feeling and to numb them from anything that would be unpredictable, where your stuff rips that off. It's like you almost kind of, like, if you watch a couple of these things on the site, you almost feel compelled to go out and chop wood or something. You want to move. And I just, you know, I don't want to, you can't watch this stuff and go, okay, I'm full. I'm going to go back to doing, vegging on the couch here. I mean, you want to go out and, like, you know, clean a house or something. And it's that vitamin, that energy you give, because it's a visual art, like you said in the beginning, but it has a kinesthetic quality to it. How do you get that when you're dealing with inner work? Because the preparation and the recovery from this stuff must be equally deep to be able to get that high, you know, when you're out there doing the performing. Are you guys like Zen, practice, meditation practice? You guys do, you know, equally go deeper within yourself to get grounded to do this kind of stuff, or is it just like a beehive in everybody's head?
Well, I think each of the dancers, I don't even think of myself as an educator, Mark. Each of the dancers at Streb, Extreme Action, some of them do yoga, some of them take ballet, some of them go to the gym, some of them run like mad, because it's so anaerobic and so aerobic, the mixture of the two. We recently had a new dancer who was a smoker, you know, and I was saying to him, look, I don't think so. If you can do it, hey, go ahead, try. He couldn't even get through 1 3-minute piece, you know. So they figure out for themselves. They're all professionals. They're mostly in their 20s, and they each regulate their practice. Everything they eat, everything they do all day long has to do with the preparation for being able to walk out on that stage or onto the mat and into the machines that we create and do this stuff. It's pretty big, a pretty big focus and a very big passion and dedication. You know, your whole life has to revolve around it.
What's been the attitude? You're very close to it. What's been the attitude, the feedback from Broadway with this work? Have you gotten people from that community, which is another circle that has a certain little kind of culture within itself, looking out from the world out? Has Broadway really connected with you guys yet, or are you still basically, you know, worlds apart?
We have. We've had actually one producer a year ago who we were going to be off Broadway starting this last February, but the investor pulled out a year ago. And now we're working with all Broadway designers on a new show called Fort Strebs Forces. I mean, they have, and a couple producers from Uptown and Las Vegas have been interested. It just never has come to fruition yet.
Okay. Because it seems to be, the choreography part seems to be a natural fit. And you know, I always think of you know, Wendy Wetzwig and some of the other choreographers that came through kind of in that 70s era when you were coming through, that got into movement as a form of sort of experiential learning and being able to actually understand your design by the way that you express yourself through movement rather than through words. There's a nonverbal, I don't even want to call it a dialogue. It's more like a nonverbal melee that goes on. If you watch any of these videos, guys, and I've been talking about this for half an hour here, but if you watch some of these videos and you just pick one person to focus on and watch as they, you know, go around the horn here, they're doing these things. They're all part of one organic body as they're doing these things. But if you just focus on one person, you watch the rhythm of how they're at the peak of the focus and then they're down the valley. Then they're at the peak. And they're all interwoven together. So it's some kind of crazy knitting experiment going on in my brain as I watch this stuff. And I think that alone.
Yeah.
What are you going to say?
I mean, that's a great idea to focus on one of the dancers. Because what you don't see on the YouTube videos or the videos on the Streb.org site are the forces that are thrashing at these bodies. A couple times you can see the dancers get ejected. And they get ejected off this yellow gizmo machine 20 feet away, you know, 20 feet away. And it's really, I'm not sure if there's any, even circus performers, because we were asked by Cirque du Soleil in 2004 when they celebrated their 20th anniversary, you know, to go up to Montreal and have some Streb work and some Cirque work. And it was the first time I noticed the grammar of action and tried to distinguish what made Streb not circus and what makes circus circus. But these guys in the circus, they don't land, they don't impact, they don't experience a failure of flight. They aren't willing to do that. It's anathema to circus people to land. That landing is, really landing and taking the hit is death to them, to the traditional circus performance.
If you guys want to make a distinction, there's a lot of thud in this stuff. There's a lot of, oh my God. And you absorb the shock as much as you absorb the elation. So there's a sense of you're in a physical environment that is just as, you know, obvious as what you're seeing is what you're feeling. Where you're right, Cirque du Soleil is very much like the ballet, very much like the ice dancing, where these people just seem ephemeral to you. They seem like they're almost immortal, and you're just kind of like dipping into their world. And, oh my God, you know, I always think of that commercial, the Principal insurance commercial, where they're like holding each other like a flag and stuff like that. These people aren't me. Yeah. I can't identify, but I can identify with landing. You know, like almost with the sound that you're going to go through the floor. When someone comes down off one of these trapeze things and they thump down, you go, whoa, that must have really shocked them. And you see the reaction. Like I used to send depressed people when everyone was coming in, you know, with their Prozac prescription. I used to send them two places. Just send them to the playground down the street here to watch the kids play. And if they were really depressed, I'd send them to the circus. And I'd say, pick a clown, pick a trapeze person, and just follow them. The entire performance. Don't follow them when they're on the stage. Follow them all over the place. And that was the way I connected with it, and that's the way I kind of learned how to take that visceral experience. Like, if you put a camera on one of these people, it'd be wild to watch them, you know, through a whole performance through that eye and see how they experience the show.
Yeah, no, it's really, I mean, I can hear what you're saying. I think it's a great idea, but I don't think you walk away unchanged when you watch people do certain superhuman activities physically. You become the superhero that they are exercising somehow by transference, even if you're not going to stay for the Slam Inclusive. You all of a sudden are a superhero because you've been in the room and you've watched it. And it really is something that I don't think exists anywhere else. I think we're the only ones that, well, take that kind of hit, except for football players, hockey players, and maybe boxers, maybe.
I'm just going to say, I played hockey for 14 years, you know, pickup leagues and things like that, and you know, in various degrees of skill and all different surfaces. And the closest I could think about when I was watching these things is this is like me playing hockey when I was 16 years old and there was no refs.
Right. It
was perpetual action. And being a goalie, you're in this state of watching everything, and all of a sudden the action comes towards you, and then you have to control it. And there was that ebb and flow to it. And there's a certain sort of visual thirst that you get when you're around people that are doing real things in a very hyper surreal way that sticks with you. That CGI
really,
can't do.
What is CGI?
CGI, you know, the movies, you know, when they computer graphic stuff
and they make it fake. Yeah.
You know, there's a certain reel to it.
And when you're thinking of, you know, like Matrix 2 and 3, I thought Matrix 1 had just perfect degree ratio of special effects because you could almost believe it was physically real. And I think what makes us not that is that you're sitting there, and these are live bodies, three-dimensionally flinging themselves around. There's no pretense. You wouldn't ever be able to special effects what Streb does, I don't think, and have it have the physical timing and the force energy that we actually manufacture.
Yeah, I mean, there was a movie out earlier this year called Kick-Ass, where the guy became a superhero who had, like, no powers at all, and he was emulating things, and they actually show him in a fight, and, you know, and people are getting, you know, cut up. It's a very, very bloody movie. But the thing was the movie a couple weeks ago I saw, The Losers, very much like that, where you actually can identify and feel for the character because they're not using a lot of the graphics as a way to cheat the people. You know, because the summer's always about just kind of like bombarding people with sounds and light and things like that. And the movies that, to me, that connect are the ones that are all, you use the adjective, Streb-like. That actually makes the character three-dimensional, where you actually get a sense of what they're risking and what they're being rewarded for. And that's what you see when you watch even a 3 or 4 minute video up here. There is a challenge there. And like you said, the failure of flight, which is that thud, I never thought of, you always think about landing. But it's the failure of flight. It's the success of flight and the failure of flight. There's that wave,
right.
which is a language that is lost on almost everybody out there now, because we're all trying to get that insurance policy where there's no risk,
Excuse me, man.
And I don't understand that. And especially in a world of action, you're just driving around Brooklyn, you've got risk. You know, so it's like, I don't understand why we're always so prone to insulating ourselves. And I guess with some of you, you've got a summer camp starting up July 5th, actually, it looks like.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. 4 weeks summer camp for kids ages 6 to 16. What goes on at the camp? How do they get involved? And just give us a little pop on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, you just go to www.streb.org, and you can hit the box on the front of the website for the summer camp and register right there. And every week is designed to be something slightly different. You can do the circus arts. You can do the pop action classes, or you can take two weeks in a row, or all four. It's really beautifully described right there on the site. And kids just come from all over the city and go in there. And I wanted to say there's another great box up there for this summer, and it's Philippe Petit, who is the man on wire who walked between the World Trade Towers. And I have pretty much stalked him for 20 years, to be honest. And we've just installed an official Philippe Petit tightrope at Slam. And August 9th, he's starting workshops there. And the registration form is also on the front of our website there, if you're interested in learning from the master, you know.
And that's I might have to show up for that. That sounds one of those
things. I'm
definitely taking
it.
You're taking it.
I'm taking it August 9th.
Could be shoulder to shoulder with Elizabeth. This is wild. Okay, so we'll definitely pass that along. And you also got a camp I see in August for kids 3 to 5.
Yeah, we take a little bit.
So, can you imagine being a 3-year-old and your introduction to the world of action to you guys? I mean, what would gym class look like to them after that? Dodgeball is going to seem like, what is this?
bunch,
wow.
of, bunch of wimps, man. Well, we start with age 1.5. We call it,
the bipedal class?
No, but it's really beautiful the way those kids move. They're that young, but the parents or the guardians take it with them. But we don't have a senior class yet. But senior meaning, uh-huh. I guess I'm getting close to that now. But I mean like 60s, 70s, 80s. We don't have that yet. So we're still not fully maximized at SLAM, but we're getting there.
Wow. Well, maybe that generation will be the 60-year-olds, down the line that'll do this for their whole lifetime. Because to me, like I said, this is a bug I caught a long time ago, probably when the first hockey puck hit me in the face or something, and it hasn't left. But in case you guys have heard her name or seen her name, you've actually been on Nurse Jackie a number of times. Is that something that you're going to be doing as a recurring character, or you kind of been there, done that? Because that's another community I know well about over at the Silver Cup Studios there, but people that work in that community too, and that's a show that has a following that is very much like the Streb following, where they glue on to it and the characters have a lot of depth. So what's it like on the set of Nurse Jackie?
Well, I mean, in fact, it's not me on the set of Nurse Jackie. It's the woman, Anna Deavere Smith, who's written the introduction or the foreword for my book. She is one of my, her foreword really described from an actor's point of view, in a beautifully analytic manner, what Streb pop action actually does, and she is one of my big action heroes, and so are the people who blurbed the book, Mikhail Baryshnikov, Philippe Petit blurbed the book, Trisha Brown, I think one of the greatest choreographer of all times, and of course the Dean of Graduate Studies, Catherine Stimson. So the book has other people's points of view in it as well as mine. But you know what? Sometimes I feel I'm on Nurse Jackie. I'm one of the biggest Nurse Jackie fans in the world. I think it's such a great show.
I was going to say that. I'm reading the blurb here on Amazon. I just completely screwed it up, but I see there was your co-writer.
Yeah.
And I just know from Silver Cup Studios has been the home of a lot of the Soprano things like that. The atmosphere in that world, very, very inclusive, very, very kind of like, it's almost like going into a somewhat of a dreamscape in a way. The people that work there come out of there, go back on the street, and they literally have to go to Clark Kent, back to their regularly scheduled identity because it's so immersive. That show happens to be very much like Sopranos in the sense that the characters are very, very tight. The show is very, like I said, it has that glue to it that I think your community seems to express. So it's that's what you're out here for. You're out here to have that community, have that feel. You have a talent to actually make this much more of an open community, an inviting community, an expanding community, which to me is rare. And like I said, if I had a hat, I'd take it off. And I just want to thank you for
thank
this little sprint through the world of Streb. And we wish you luck. Go to the site, go to the camp, read the book, get some, hand on the elephant here of this thing, because I want to see this thing get as widespread and as well known as possible, because I think it's going to save a lot of people a lot of time on the couch and a lot of time at the drugstore, because they will absolutely be fully human by experiencing this and being able to share it with others. So thanks for joining us here on Somatime, and hang on 1 minute for you and for you guys listening. Just continue listening to Somatime. I'll be right back.
All right, there you go, Elizabeth Streb.
Wow. That conversation was pretty unique because we both had a lot going on under the radar there that was being said, between the lines. Hope you guys, followed the tennis match there between us, because we've both sort of been, on the outside looking in on our respective fields for a long time, and I just thought it was a wonderful interview, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the world that she's been in, and then how her mission, unique from everybody else we've interviewed, everyone else has a different story, has a purpose and has a very clear heart to it that I hope the guys came across during the conversation. So, anyway, so shifting gears. Let's take a look at Obama here quick, because on the opposite side of the coin, we have this stiff and out of touch, overwrought federal official.
I was down there a month ago, before most of these talking heads were even paying attention to the Gulf. A month ago, I was meeting with fishermen down there, standing in the rain, talking about what a potential crisis this could be. And I don't sit around just talking to experts because this is a college seminar. We talk to these folks because they potentially had the best answers, so I know who's asked to kick.
There you go. Now, he's definitely going for the Onto there. He's going for the I'm the boss, you know. But the way he goes about it, after everything that's going on, we're talking, we're over 50 days into this. You know, he's been told by his circle, you know, you got to connect more, you got to show emotions. But he is a hyper-rational guy anyway. He's EXO. He's EXO. Imagine an Etch-a-Sketch board in your head for every problem you think about. You know, there's just a unique way of processing that he doesn't connect to the mainstream, populace, because they're wired for, you know, that Philo sense of vulnerability. He doesn't have vulnerability. So he doesn't look like he's taking this as seriously as everybody else. I'm sure he has not, you know, been able to sleep with two eyes closed for the last 2 months where this has been going on. And it isn't like he's had, you know, a days off from the borderline stuff in Arizona, you know, with the whole immigration thing. We had the Times Square thing. We rattled off 8 or 10 other crises that he's been in. And even some scandals, you know, the Blagojevich trial still going on. So he's got issues. Yeah. Time for me to cough. Let's see if I can get that up there. It's still there. I don't know. I think it took it out. I didn't use it enough. No, I don't see it. Wow, that's amazing. The smart system here. I'll give you a woo-woo for that.
Woo-woo! You know what I'm saying? Then you got the flows. They didn't trip off the flow masses.
That decoration, man.
Yeah.
Just the decoration, man.
That's the decoration, man. So anyway, that was Obama. So I just, you know, the latest stuff, the news down there hasn't been good. And it's really at a point now where there's almost like Gulf fatigue setting in. The more you wake up in the morning and you see another beach with more globs of oil and, you know, more pelicans covered with the soot and all that stuff, and the more of these guys spinning and spinning and spinning, and, oh, there's not really plumes, there's clouds, and there's only parts per million and things. It really has reduced that whole crisis to the difference between the corporate America that we all live in, and I mean the entire world. The entire world lives in corporate America. Just don't know it. There's different streets on the, on the map, but we're all in it. And the jingoistic, idealistic, red, white, and blue, you know, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, Chevrolet America that is pushed at us through images and advertising and just a myriad of these big sort of like almost like overgrown sort of ethos that we have to just suffer under all the time. Because you're an American, you must blank, or you're not an American. And all those little tests. And when we become human first, and maybe earthlings, you know, and start realizing that a lot of these boundaries are just that. They're just made up, man. They're not really there. We're always going to have that separation. We're always going to have that fear because of the other. And, you know, whatever wingnut political stuff that you listen to will have you target different people. Like the stuff that's going on in Gaza, you know, is sort of a microcosm of this. And the reaction has been another thing. Like if you're not loyal to Israel, then you're that. If you're more towards, like, look what happened to Helen Thomas the other day when she just, you know, let the floodgates open up and spoke, you know, off the top of her head. This long career, over 50 years of covering presidents, she was gone in a couple of days. You don't think that's because of the sensitivity in this country to perception and to political correctness? We're more bound up in political correctness now. It's really weird. When Clinton was in office, political correctness was an issue, right? Post 9/11, big time political correctness. And so how do you innovate? How do you honestly have a conversation if everything you're going to say, free speech, and then you say what you want to say, and then people will blackball you for it. And, you know, we've had Eric Qualman on the show, you know, talking about social media and how it's keeping us much more transparent. And, you know, look at it. It's taken down, I don't know how many politicians and how many other people in the last 6 months, you know, the way the TMZ culture works. It's scary how many things are recorded and transcribed, and you know, you go to Deadspin. There's just every day there's more sports, you know, gossip in there. We love it. We can't get enough of it. We can't get enough of people's secrets. We can't get enough of people's private lives. We can't get enough of the innuendos. We can't get enough of the backstories and the emails and the memos and all the little things. Every little office conflict is played out like a, you know, like a soap opera for our amusement. And then we go, like I saw this movie, the Get Into the Greek movie over the weekend. And, you know, it's a movie that not too long ago, maybe back in the Bush administration, wouldn't have been perceived as being something that the country would have been receptive to, because we were experiencing a lot of, I don't want to say guilt, but a lot of self-reflection about drugs, right? And now we're in a situation where we're trying to legalize all these drugs, and so we're back to the partying, we're back to the, you know, the happy drunk rock star, and the cartoonish, you know, world that they live in, and that's you know, that's enough to make it the number one movie in America. I saw it. There's some funny lines in there, but it takes you three quarters of the movie to give a rat's butt if the guy lives or dies, because you know he's a, you know, he's an addict that's out of control. So we've taken addiction, and we've desensitized ourselves to that because recovery is something hardly anybody experiences. So like if you imagine like a wave, we're all about the upswing, we're all about the peak, and you know, striving for the carrots above our heads, and we're always straining and reaching for this fame and fortune and celebrity and achievement and you know, immortality and all those other things. And then on the other side, the dark side, all the way down the other side of the mountain into the valley of despair, we basically have that Schadenfreude. We want others to experience that. We want other countries and other worldviews and other religions and other political views and other sports teams. Let them suffer. Let me have this, you know, achievement in my life. So there's that dynamic to it. And, you know, Elizabeth talks about the failure to fly, that thud when you hit the ground. That's very real in her work. And we polarized to this. We don't accept both sides of it. We don't accept down with up. So, of course, we live in the fear of failure and the fear of not succeeding. So where does that leave us? Not very grounded, right? That's the point. That's what I'm trying to say. So, all right, so we're going to finish up here with a little Stanley Cup review, and then we'll take a look at what's going on, because the Blackhawks are winning in the third period. I'm jinxing it again, sons of bitches. All right, so here's a little moment in time. Let's see. 3-2 is 12 and a half minutes to go. Check in here live. It is 3-2 Blackhawks. Again, 1961. This son of a bitch is going to go overtime and drag me through this, isn't it? Wow. Not a foul play. Just under 12 and a half minutes to go here. 3-2 Chicago. Again, the Flyers have to win to force a Game 7 on Friday night. This poor guy does the games, though. The screaming. I mean, can you imagine this? Give me the butter in there! I miss some toast! I mean, how does this guy come down for this stuff? Flies are all over me. I'm just going to take a little beat here. Before the next whistle, I'll play my Ranger clip. But hockey, man. Your eyeballs just... It's like... It's always weird because you always watch it off to the side. And as a goalie, you're watching it come at you and move away from you. So it's like the ocean rolling in. There's no whistles in this third period. This is wild. He's rattling up the minutes here. 11 and a half. Boy, a goal here by the Blackhawks would be big. Finally, a whistle. And Doc Emmerich takes a breath. All right, so as we do that, let's take a look at... Whoa, wait a minute. What the hell is that? Cup. What is that? I want to see... the Stanley Cup riot, 1994. Rangers win the Stanley Cup. I think I would have done this beforehand, huh? Stanley Cup celebration. I wonder when he says it. I'll take a look at this one here. Hey. Get that for you. No problem. Just a little maintenance here. All right, let's see if we got something here. That's the riot. Let's see. I want to hear that. The Stanley Cup. Where is it? Messier guarantee. Cup celebration. No, that's not it. Making me mad. I'll try one of these in a minute here. Sorry, guys. I should have played this before. I saw the cup and the thing, and then it didn't play. Is that it? I got something out of this. I just want to make, I want to put a punctuation on this stuff. This is the end of the game. This is the, the beheard stuff. It's cute, but it's not what I wanted. No. Enough of you. I wanted to go live to the game here. You got me doing this. There's the up. Who did this?
Whether you're a fan 4 years old, 64 years old, 84 years old, no matter how long you've waited, this is something special.
Look at the hands. These guys have white gloves on carrying the Stanley Cup. That is
16 years ago, guys.
And it's going to have the New York Rangers all over it.
Well, New York, after 64 years, your long wait is over. Congratulations to the Rangers and the Vancouver Canucks for a spectacular final. Congratulations to Bob Gutkowski, Neil Smith, and Mike Keenan, the entire Ranger organization, and most importantly, the players. Captain Mark
Messier,
come get the Stanley Cup.
I'm freaking out. I'm freaking out here. Simply the best. Here he goes. The Messiah.
Tina Turner's song.
Unbelievable.
Simply the best, blaring on the loudspeaker. That's the song the Rangers listen to.
There he is, holding the cup. Oh, I'm freaking out. Getting teary-eyed.
He came to New York 3 years ago. This Stanley Cup. To deliver the Stanley Cup.
Oh.
And there it is.
All right, I can't take any more. I'm going to get too emotional in the air. All right, back to the game here. We got just over 6.5 minutes to go. No, 8 minutes. 8 minutes and 20 seconds. This is an eternity. Somebody stick one in here, make it 4-2. I'm really rooting for the Blackhawks. I hate these stinking Flyers. We got about 6 minutes to go. We might go a little overtime here. We'll try and get this game over with. There's no whistle, so it's good. We might make it. So if you're streaming live with me, you have to catch the end on the archive. I'm going to try and stay to the end of the game here. I mean, I can't imagine a Chicago Blackhawks fan that has any saliva in their mouth right now or any eye juice in his head. His eyeballs are staring straight ahead. Flyer fans got to feel some anxiety, though. But, I mean, there's such a Cinderella story that they've pulled that thing, more things out of their hat. Oh, no. Here comes... Flyers seem to be going around the edges more. Ooh, Hossa, this guy's looking for a cup for 3 years. Imagine you play 1 year for the Red Wings and the Penguins win. Play the next year for the Penguins and the Red Wings win. Or maybe it was vice versa. But he was in the cup final 2 years in a row on the wrong team. Now he's on the Blackhawks, which probably helps the Flyer fans right now. All right, we got a whistle. We got 6:45 to go. Well, it is wild in there. I mean, the energy in that room right now is as intense as it gets. This is all I can tell you. It's just so intense. Everything about the Stanley Cup is just unspeakably intense. So anyway, looks like we're gonna have commercials and all kinds of BS. So I'm not gonna be able to finish up on the air with you here, but I'm gonna try and stay around. I'm gonna stick around and see if we can get at least down to. A couple minutes left when they come back here, because they're going to try and stretch this game to 11 if they can, the regulation, how many commercials they got left. But so anyway, if you guys got any questions about Elizabeth Streb's interview, you can get me at nakedsummer@gmail.com. Next week, I'm not sure yet. We haven't confirmed yet. We're trying to see if we're going to do it before Father's Day or after. I'm trying to get the author of The Male Brain, which is Dr. Luann Brizendine. Who also wrote The Female Brain, if you haven't caught her act. And we'll talk about the impact of social media on fatherhood and how it's changed the way that we perceive what it means to be a dad in 2010. It's going to be an interesting thing to do around Father's Day. I know I have really had an opportunity to change my outlook on the way that goes as I learn more about the physiology of fatherhood from my first-hand experience, let alone my second-hand. Anyway, we'll try and do that in a couple weeks. We're also going to get Mike Silver on here from New York Baseball Digest. He said he would check in with us about all the events going on in sports media. We definitely want to get that in as we head to the summer. Like I said, I want to cover a little bit about the World Cup and about how soccer is very much a sport, especially World Cup energy, that has that Olympic sense of identity. That I want to see if we can get into that a little bit about the social media around that. Maybe we'll do that in a couple of weeks. All right, we're back here. Again, if you're streaming with us, sorry, we're going to probably go overtime here, so we'll catch it on the on the archive. I know hardly anybody cares about this stuff but me, but, screw it. Let me see if I can find that the Stanley Cup. Oh, I'm looking here. So now you're getting at a part of the hockey game where, like, they're tired, but they're also, like, in a total state of panic. Your legs are burning. Your hair is, like, on fire. You can't really see straight. Oh, my God. I mean, if it goes overtime, I mean, these poor fans are going to be, they're going to be spooning themselves out of their chairs. I've seen a lot of this. I've seen too much, actually. Stanley Cup Finals, late Stanley Cup Finals. Weird stuff happening. I mean, this is... Just wild stuff. It's such a different energy when you watch the basketball finals, because there's so much scoring in basketball, because basketball comes down to the last 2 minutes in a regular season game. You're sort of like rehearsed. Hockey is so much different than other sports. I mean, it's a continuum. There's no out of bounds, really. The puck goes out of play. Oh, put it in. Nobody. That should have been the tap-in goal. The guy overskated it. 5.5 minutes left. This is wild. Oh. I'm exhausted. I can't even hear. The show's on, but not streaming. All right, so I guess we're in overtime right now, literally. Trying to land this plane here for you guys here. A little summertime extra time here. Remember, a lot of the Blackhawks played on the U.S. Olympic team. Ooh. 4:55 to go. Icing touch-up. Oh, guys, I don't know. I don't know if I want to stick around. I want to go watch this myself instead of talking to you guys, actually. But I think I'm gonna let the mystery remain on the air and let you guys figure it out for yourself. But I will play us out to see if I can find old Tina here. Let me see if I found the Stanley Cup thing first. I think it's still doing its thing over here. Refresh. All right, here's Cup Celebration. Let's see. Championship Film Part 7. Try to see if I got anything here. But here's a celebration that goes on for how many minutes? 7 minutes? This is the same thing. It starts out up. I don't want to hear that. All right, let me see if I can get Tina over here. Tina Turner. Play us out to that. And I'll see if I can plead in a little Rangers at the same time. Simply the best. Where are you? Where are you? There she is. Good old Tina. Oh, man. All right, come on. Again, no planning. Oh, they got the live version. Oh, that's not going to help me. Well, it's 30 seconds. Okay, let's see. I'll pause it. Live in Europe. Yeah, Tina. Gotta love the Tina. All right, so hold that mud. See if we got anything here. It looks like they get the trophy here when they get the Stanley Cup. Stanley Cup Riot now. There's a film. Boy. No, that's the parade. I don't want that. Let's see. It's a celebration. That's the same thing. Yeah, all right. Sorry. All right, Tina. I'm going to play us out here. We got a little over 4 minutes to go here in Philadelphia. So I'll put that on. And we'll play a little Tina here for you. All right, guys. Have a good weekend. See you here next week, 9 o'clock on Zoma Time. Thanks for this time and your space. And as always, travel light through the darkness.